Hello, and welcome to the next segment of Buffalo Who Knew, a podcast that highlights the often underappreciated, sometimes unearthed, assets of Buffalo, and particularly as it relates to art and culture and the built and natural environments. I am super excited today. We're going to talk about a legendary New York art dealer and Buffalo native, Martha Kellogg Jackson, otherwise known to many in the art world as Martha Jackson. And today I'm here with two venerable art world people who are at UB Art Galleries, Bob Scalise, who is the director, and Anna Wager, who is the curator of exhibitions. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So glad to have you both. I had the luck of going out to see the new exhibition you've just mounted, which opens on tomorrow, on Martha in Martha Jackson in Paris, and so this is timely that we talk about Martha. I don't think a lot of people know that Martha Jackson was from Buffalo, who she is. So let's dive in a little bit. Who is Martha Jackson? Talk about her background, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well. Yeah, I think get back to what you started with. I think more people internationally in the art world know about Martha Jackson than people even in Buffalo and appreciate her for all that she's done in the contemporary arts. As you noted, Martha was a Buffalonian, born in Buffalo, born in 1907, part of the Kellogg family. Which was a well-to-do family from prospering in linseed oil business. She grew up here. She went to Park School. Was an avid horseback rider. She was very athletic into sports. Was very accomplished competitive rider. And took art classes while she was at Park. After that, she went on to Smith College, where she majored actually in English. And from what I've read, she really didn't take any art classes while at Smith, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. Graduated from Smith, moved back, ended up marrying here in Buffalo to a florist named John Anderson. Eventually, that didn't work out, and she remarried. But she, while she was here, she took classes at the then Albright School. Was obviously a visitor there and appreciated the collections here in Buffalo. Jump in here at any
sure,
time.
Sure. Yeah. So. I think the sort of Buffalo roots are really formational in her art mm-hmm. appreciation. Obviously, the Albright Knox has such an incredible modern art collection. But that really kickstarts for her in the 1940s. Her second husband was stationed at a military base outside of Baltimore, and she needed things to do while she was in Baltimore and ends up taking a class from Adeline Breeskin, who was the director of the Baltimore Museum of Art and who taught classes with Johns Hopkins occasionally. And that was kind of her intro to French art, to kind of more avant-garde movements. And so she brings that knowledge back to Buffalo when his service is done. She divorces that second husband and takes off for New York in 1949. Mm.
And while in Baltimore, that's when she actually made her first purchase.
Yes, a Marc Chagall, that was part of a show, I think, at the Baltimore Museum of Art. And Breeskin even noted at the time, that was a good pick of, she had a good eye.
Was it a Chagall print, or was it a
gouache? Gouache.
And that gouache later showed at the Museum of Modern Art, and she sold it for a significant profit, from what I understand. And that was her first experience seeing that, okay, well, I have a good eye. You can buy art and resell it and actually make money.
Mm-hmm. And then buy more art and then start the process all over again. Yeah.
So she moves to New York, and I believe I read that at some point she comes in contact with Hans Hoffman.
Yes. So similar to her time in Baltimore, she starts taking art classes. Mm-hmm. With Hoffman, like Bob noted, she kind of was more of an English person in college. She actually writes poetry her entire life. We used her book of poems in a show a couple of years ago, which was really special. But she's starting off as a painter. There's this kind of apocryphal story that Hoffman is the one who says to her, "You're not that good of a painter, but you have a really good eye." We don't love that story because it sort of puts a lot of the impetus of her career on, you know, on Thomas Hoffman. But regardless, it does sort of indicate, like, she comes to the conclusion, maybe I don't want to be an artist.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know,
and she has resources.
And she has resources.
She has gets sensationalized in a lot of different ways.
For sure.
She had the means. She had a good eye. She was buying art. Hoffman was watching her in critiques and was taking her around when she wanted to be introduced to artists, things like that. So it was a natural progression, I think, of saying, like, hey, Martha, you're a good painter, but you have the eye. You could have the drive. I see the way you're working. This New York is ripe for a gallery showing contemporary abstraction that was just getting big at the time. Why not?
And except she's a woman, which is, you know, a big factor here. So let's talk about the climate for women. And I mean, were there prominent women art gallerists at this point?
There were several.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, Betty Parsons, I think, is the obvious one that comes to mind. Peggy Guggenheim, I think we think of as more of a collector, but also had her own gallery as well. There's a few others, but I mean, significantly fewer female gallerists than male gallerists, obviously.
Yeah.
So she goes to New York. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Edith Halpern, who had gallery, and there's a great book on her story, Girl with a Gallery. But
yeah.
So she starts to get in the mix in New York. She's hobnobbing with Paul Jenkins and Hans Hoffman and people like that, and starts going around. And so how does she actually open or get into having her first gallery? Do you know that?
She ended up leasing a townhouse on 22 East 66th Street, which is just off Madison Avenue. And the whole front was a glass facade. So she had her gallery. There was space downstairs that eventually she opened with her son David coming part of the business and really centered on works on paper. And then she lived upstairs and in the back too. So that was when she really made the leap of faith into leasing this building. And her first show was 100 Years of Watercolors, which was more modernist watercolors, traditional watercolors, of just stepping into doing her first shows. But even in that first year, she had 11 exhibitions, I believe. So it was pretty ambitious of not just tippy-toeing in, of jumping in.
And living in the same building, like really living into it, like cooking from a hot plate in the back and just, you know, just spending all of her time and energy and money doing it.
Amazing. Yeah. So she starts to build a name, and how does she cultivate her artists? Do we have some insight into who she gravitated to and why? And
I mean, I think so again, a lot of folks who we would consider sort of the forerunners of abstract expressionism, she's clearly very interested in abstraction. A lot of it is the network in New York. You already mentioned Paul Jenkins. That's a huge one for her. Again, folks that were around Hans Hoffman in that circle. But the exhibition that we just are opening focuses on that network in Paris. And she goes to Paris the gallery, Martha Jackson Gallery, opens in 1953. She goes to Paris for the first time intentionally for the gallery in 1954. So it's almost immediate. And there is this sort of international coterie of artists that she is intentionally cultivating, which was very exciting for us to kind of delve into. We have a really early sketch of hers where it's like contemporary art around the world. So the styles are really different. Like I said, a lot of it is very abstract, but there's lyrical, there's more kind of art brut, there's different formalism things happening. So it's not like there's one thing she sort of locks into. Pop art is one of the things that she really doesn't lock into. Like, she knows her clientele. We have some really incredible letters between her and Andy Warhol, for example, where she's like, "You're going to be just fine. This work is very interesting. It's, you know, it's not for me." Kind of, it's not
like,
for my.
And it shows how tough she was too.
Yeah,
where she's like, it didn't. I'm paraphrasing here, so please. She says something like, "It didn't take long to see what people thought of your work." And all I had to do was wave some pictures around, and there were immediate responses to it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Shocking, but which says a lot for your work, and I believe in it. And then she goes on to say that, you know, that's not the gallery that she's building, and she owes it to her artists continue to support them. And she actually recommends that he should talk to Leo Castelli, which had a long
that was a famous relationship
with
yeah.
Warhol.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's quite, I think, quite known for doing that sort of connecting, too. If she knows someone isn't for her, she can kind of point who, you know, who they could show with more effectively.
So she's building an international cadre of artists, which is pioneering at that era. She's focused on abstract expressionists, correct? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's also the only other kind of other big group I'd mention too is op art. So artists that are doing things with optical effects. Mm. Julian Stanzak, Anuskiewicz. She has the first like quote unquote op art show in New York. She also has the first what we would kind of consider installation based exhibition in New York City. It was actually a 2-part exhibition called New Forms, New Media. The first one was so popular they did a second one. Yeah. So, and we have really amazing like documentation photos from those shows as well. So a lot of paintings, a lot of abstract paintings, but kind of all over the place.
And remarkably that New Forms, New Media, there was, I should know how many artists were in it, but a lot.
Our
Jack Drummer was in it.
Yeah.
Buffalo born. Yeah. And even in the first couple of years, relating back to Buffalo, she was showing a lot of emerging artists, contemporary artists, established ones, but also Buffalo artists. She showed Seymour Drumlovich, Martha Visserhof in New York in the early to mid-50s, I should say. And really, there was a lot of galleries popping up there, and what set her apart, you know, you could talk about a lot of different things, but she was really promoting an artist-first mentality there and a business model where she not only invested in the artists, but I think really she invested in the artists first. Mm. And she paid their medical bills, got them studio space, bought paintings outright from them. So the artist got the money up front. And then she would put it into shows and figure out how to place it in different places. So, you know, those relationships that she built with artists weren't temporary. I think she was really nurturing those relationships and making sure that they were long term. And you could see that with some of the artists like Stanzak, Jenkins for sure, who was represented by her throughout the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s with David. But I think that's what really set her apart, that she cared about the people and cultivated a community around her gallery.
Hmm.
And I think really recognize that, like, if artists are hungry or if they don't have a safe place to live, like, they can't create. Like, which is such a basic thing to think about, right? But there is a real, just safety and maintenance that she was doing a lot of and spending a lot of time with.
So how long does she live in Paris? And tell me a little bit about what you've uncovered in mounting this exhibition that's just opening.
Yeah, sure. So she is, she's back and forth between New York and Paris, if not yearly, every other year or so. It's not like she's there in Paris full time, but she'll be there for 2 months, 3 months, that kind of thing. We have some great photos of her and John Hultberg and a couple other artists like on the deck of the Queen Mary, like going to Paris. So like they'd all travel together too. And then several of her artists would usually be there at once, and they would be swapping studios with people in New York. So there was a constant kind of like flow between the two. And she does that until her death in 1969. Her son, David Anderson, who's a really important gallerist in his own right as well, also has a gallery in Paris in
61.
Yeah, okay.
He opened that with Jack Mayer, and it was Gallery Anderson Mayer.
Yeah, so then she also has kind of like eyes there for a more sustained period of time as well. But she's also getting, one of the things that's been really exciting about this exhibition is getting to spend time with her correspondents. So we hold her archive, we hold her sale records, and she was a very meticulous record keeper. So we have carbon copies of most of her letters to folks, and then we have their return letters to her. So one of the things that's been fun to chart out is like who is hanging out with who when, mm-hmm. and them sort of reporting back on like, oh, Tapie's opening was great, sorry you had to miss it, or mm-hmm. Paul Jenkins is giving money to someone else on her behalf, kind of thing. So
well, that's the thing where that archive is just so valuable and insightful, and not just the business side and our historical side, but the personal side mm-hmm. of bringing you into that environment and that time and place and what was going on. Mm-hmm. Like you said, who was talking and hanging out with who and just experiencing Paris, per se, in this show during the 1960s, which is remarkable.
And all the while, she's still maintaining a relationship to Buffalo. She comes back, correct? And and she has a relationship with Albright.
Seymour Knox Jr.
But at that time the Albright, it's Albright Knox at that point.
Know when it changed. Yeah. I should say.
But certainly she and I read that she was helping Seymour Knox amass his collection, and you know, was as he proceeded to buy the best of the best from the 50s to the 70s, so which ultimately went to the museum. So Martha dies an unfortunate, early, unexpected death in her 60s, and what happens to her massive collection that she's amounted. So it wasn't just that she was running a gallery, she also amassed a really important collection, and you know, of major. So whom did she collect?
Well, even taking a step back to the relationship with the Albright, I'd have to say, like, she was very good friends with Seymour Knox Jr. and Gordon Smith, the director at the time. So having her there, and another Buffalonian, born Buffalo, Cindy Janis, the dealer, who's also in New York. So when the gallery was actively buying, is rumored, I guess, I don't have it documented, but that Seymour would always call Martha first. She'd open doors, help advocate or negotiate for purchases for the Albright. So, and that's really documented in our archives with the AKG now, and it was highlighted, a lot of that work that she helped with in The Long Curve that was at the Albright Knox Art Gallery several years ago.
Also, just to add quickly to one of the artists in this exhibition, Larry Cacano, she recommended him for a position at the Albright Art School, and we have that letter of her saying, like, I think that he would be a good fit for this. And that's someone who has no Buffalo connections at all, but she's also helping place people into positions and thinking of Buffalo the whole time she's doing that, for sure.
So getting to the point where she passed away at the age of 62, which is crazy, but she amassed a huge collection, and not only thinking about the business model and what artwork was in the gallery holdings, but her personal collection and things like that. So it was a huge collection. Shortly after she passed away, David took over running the gallery and was voted to be president of the board of directors there, and mounted several large-scale donations that were legacy projects, one being the AKG, the Albright Knox Art Gallery at the time, which is known as the Martha Jackson Collection, which was in an exhibition there in 1974.
And I read that that comprised 44 artists and 40 works.
By, like, these were blue chip pieces. So like Klaus Oldenburg, Jim Dine, Carl Apple, Antoni Tapies, to name a few.
So Carl Apple and Tapies and so Joan Mitchell, right?
Grace Hardigan.
Grace Hardigan. So that goes to the Albright Knox at the time. Also, part of the collection goes to, what is it, the National...
Smithsonian.
Smithsonian. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and then David, who has been running the gallery under her name until the late 70s, right?
1979.
Yeah. And maintaining some of the same artists, but also starting to bring in his own folks, decides that he wants to migrate the business here, which is where we come in, where UPR galleries come in.
Yeah, he ran the collection in New York after 79, but not too far after that, him and his wife Becky moved back to Buffalo and started looking for a place to do something different. Looking at a new business model too, not looking to continue with Martha's vision and representing artists and advocating in that way, but showing the collection. So that's when they found a former Buffalo Public School in University Heights neighborhood here and bought it for dollars and sold one de Kooning painting titled Night Squares for $3.5 million. And that funded the whole renovation to make it into, at the time, state-of-the-art gallery space and opened it to the public in 91 as a commercial art space, which is unheard of considering the building was 20,000 square feet with over 8,000 square foot of exhibition space, which is insane. With a staff of 12 people and going. Yeah.
For those who aren't in Buffalo, it's a remarkable building. Who was the architect on that building, actually?
Interesting you say that, because all of the paperwork and things, the design was all David. David, really, his passion and I think his talent was in designing. So he came on to Martha Jackson Gallery in 1957. And you look back at all the catalogs of those exhibitions, and he was designing the New Forms New Media catalog, the Louise Nevelson sculpture catalog, the Martha Jackson Gallery logo, things like that. And obviously, he visited museums, galleries around the world for years. So I think what he got excited about bringing the collection back to Buffalo was to showcase the artwork in itself, but also to take his talents and take on a new project, find this old rundown school building and bring new life to it. And it's incredible that it's not on a main street. It's in a neighborhood. So making really accessible art to the community around us here was important to him.
And then ultimately creating a relationship with the University of Buffalo, which is extraordinary.
That's really where we come in.
Yeah. Right. So let's talk about Martha and sort of the art world recognition of her contributions. I understand that she received some major recognition posthumously. What was she recognized for? What were some of the awards that she was recognized for?
Well, Art Dealers Association on their, I believe it was their 30th anniversary, voted her one of the, or honored her as one of the top 8 most influential art dealers of the 20th century. And remarkably, if you think of them voting 8 art dealers in this category, 2 were from Buffalo. Not just her, but Sidney Janis was in there too. So I should, to give Buffalo props, having 2 amazing. Out of 8 is pretty good.
Yeah, for a future podcast, yes. For sure, Sidney Janis. I don't know, were they contemporaries in New York?
I don't
necessarily
know.
He's a bit older. I think he's a bit older, but close to it. I think they also occasionally were, working together, sharing details. And I know Sidney Janis obviously contributed a lot to the AKG as well.
So amazing. I'm glad that Martha ended up getting recognized for being such a pioneer on so many fronts. I mean, whether it be being a woman in the field or the artist from de Kooning to Oppel to, Jenkins, whom she, really coveted and gestated. I mean, she really was a trailblazer on so many levels. So I'm glad that she got recognized. Now, in accordance with this podcast, we think about, already we've talked about many things I'm sure very few people know about who aren't in your world, but what's a who knew factoid about Martha that we could maybe, share with our listeners?
Well, I think we can keep going with a lot of who.
this is a fun part for us. But.
Yeah, I think one thing that's remarkable about her gallery that who knew, maybe some people do, but thinking about how she was advocating and showing emerging artists that are now very established museum names, thinking about the first American exhibitions or first New York art shows for these artists, Martha gave these artists their first New York or American exhibition. Jim Dine, Paul Jenkins, Hasio DeMoto, Sam Francis, Antony Tapies, Christo, Adolf Gottlieb, John Chamberlain had his first exhibition, solo exhibition with Martha Jackson Gallery. Julian Stanzak, as Anna was talking about, Clayton Pond, who Anna's curating a show that's going to happen in...
April 26th. So a full career retrospective with Clayton Pond.
Alberto Burri had his first American exhibition, one-person exhibition with him, William Scott and Bob Thompson. And she also introduced international artists to the American art world, including Antony Tapies, Francesco Toledo, Carl Applet, we talked about, bringing the Gutai group from Japan to America. She was groundbreaking in so many different ways, including advocating and showing women artists that were marginalized, as you can imagine, during that time, you know, including Joan Mitchell, Barbara Hepworth, and many others.
Grace Hardigan.
Grace Hardigan, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the broader kind of fun fact, too, is that the archive is here. It's part of the University of Buffalo. We work with a decent number of international researchers often who coordinate with our registrar, Nick Osnes, to get access to some of those letters. People here do use it for certain projects, but I think it's also very underutilized by the regional community itself. And so that's also something that, you know, as we've hit our 25th anniversary of UB Art Galleries, and as we look to what's happening next for us, that's one of the things, having more of that known to the community and making it more open and accessible.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, Martha's story is really remarkable, and what David did to help foster that years after her death is definitely noteworthy. What he did with his gallery and donating the gallery, the whole building, to the university in 2000. And that was really the first time that the university established a full staff, it's a museum staff, and merged the Center for the Arts galleries with the Anderson Gallery, merging the collections. And not only did he donate the building, but he donated a $2 million endowment to support the activities within that building, and a large collection from Martha that was a mix of Martha's personal collection, the gallery collection, and all that to establish a full collection with the university. And as we talked about, the archives are just as important as this collection and get utilized by museums and researchers around the world. We're either lending work to these exhibitions, and if not, it's lending the archives for research that's used within these exhibitions. And as this stellar donation was brought to the university in 2000, and we look back on the 25 years of it being there, it's taking time to cultivate that, bringing into the university's mission, making these collections and archives accessible. And that's what we're excited about. The work that we've done, but to continue and have it all available online and making it accessible for our, not only our students, faculty, and our university community, but Buffalo's community and the greater art world around us.
Well, thank you so much for your work. This is incredible. I encourage everyone to go out to UB North and see Martha Jackson in Paris. It's up until when?
May 17th. So if you have a good amount of time. 2026, yeah. Yes. Cool. So,
all right, well, go see it. She's an important figure, not only in Western New York, but in the art world at large. Thank you both for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.